Edison said, "I never did a day's work in my life. It was all fun." Sounds wonderful, doesn't it? When work isn't work, it's fun. I can't promise that at the end of today's podcast, you'll know what work will enable you to agree with Thomas Edison, but you'll get down-to-earth practical advice that will steer you in that direction. Today, I'm speaking with an experienced career coach for young professionals, and we're going to discuss how to determine what is a meaningful career and work that you will love. Because only when you have some insight into what you will find satisfying can you make a reasonable decision about graduate education. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and ultimately successfully. My mission and passion is to help you get to that wonderful moment when you can jump up and down and yell, "Yes, I'm in." I also want to remind you of a new feature on Admission Straight Talk. We invite your questions. If you have an admissions-related question, just go to the show notes at info.accepted.com/65, and you will see a widget that will allow you to leave an audio message in which you can ask your question. You can speak using your computer mic or your phone. You can also send me questions via email at questions@accepted.com. If your question is chosen, I'll ask and answer it on the show. Now to today's guest, Akiba Smith-Francis. Akiba earned an AB, MBA, and MPA from various schools at Harvard University. She has worked as an analyst for McKinsey, a marketing manager for Clorox, an MBA admissions consultant, and as career coach for Columbia Business School and Management Leadership for Tomorrow. Today, she works for Exeter Group, a leadership development consulting firm. I had the pleasure of speaking with Akiba before she agreed to be interviewed for the podcast and really enjoyed our chat. I think you are in for a wonderful treat in this interview. I know I am. Akiba, welcome to Admission Straight Talk. I'm so pleased to have you here today.
Hi, Linda. I'm really glad to be here.
Okay, great. Could I ask you to just move a little closer to your mic or move the mouse?
Sure.
Okay.
Is this better?
Yes. Thank you so much.
Okay, great.
Okay. Now, you've done so many different things since you graduated Harvard. I just touched on highlights. How did you get into career coaching?
Yeah, that's a good question. It happens kind of circuitously, which I think is the way that so many people's careers unfold, which is hopefully one of the things that we'll be able to discuss tonight. When I was in business school, it really started with my exposure to consumer marketing, which is how I ended up getting into brand management. But I was fascinated by the subject of how people think and how they make decisions and what's important to them and how to figure that out, which led me to consumer marketing and brand management. And while I was there, I mentioned to somebody that I was helping a friend of a friend work on their application to business school, and someone shared that they had this opportunity to do this, you know, for a living. And I chatted with the person and got into MBA admissions consulting, and I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that work was really coaching.
Right.
I don't know that I had language for it at that point, but I loved helping people get clear about what it is they wanted to do professionally, what their strengths were, how to articulate it, and, of course, how to think through the path for them to get there. While I was doing that, it was through another kind of fortuitous conversation with somebody, an administrator at Columbia Business School, who saw the connections between what I was doing on the admissions consulting side and the career services office and providing those services to students. And so that's how I got into it at Columbia and kind of went from there, going from admissions consulting to working full-time as a professional development coach for MBA students. And now I work at a leadership development consulting firm where coaching is a big part of what we do.
Right. Well, I know I love the coaching part of my work, so I can really relate to that. And when we spoke a couple of weeks ago, you mentioned that people were giving you well-intentioned, but not necessarily well-thought-out, guidance when you were a McKinsey consultant about what you should be doing and the next steps you should be taking, specifically before you pursued graduate education. What advice were you getting, and why was it not the right advice for you at that time?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't customized to me at all. It was sort of like, you know that you need to go to Harvard Business School, right? I mean, that was literally, you know, some of the conversations.
Like, it was just assumed. It was just assumed, yeah, that that's what you were going to do.
Absolutely. And it wasn't even like, you should go to business school. It was like you need to go to Harvard Business School,
mm-hmm.
very specifically, without first having a conversation about what it is that interested me and what it is I wanted to do, the impact that I wanted to have in the world. And so I really chafed at that, quite frankly, because I was at that time really interested in doing international development work.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons that I started off at the Kennedy School of Government and actually didn't apply to Harvard Business School or any business school for that matter right out of McKinsey, it was sort of a cookie-cutter approach to this is what you need to be a successful person in the world, and so go do it without any kind of dialogue about what's important to the person.
It almost sounds like it was brand Uberalis. I mean, it was Harvard has an unparalleled brand. You had previously, you know, you'd gone to Harvard, you had McKinsey. Well, of course, that's what you're going to do.
Right. And I think this notion that HBS, or in some ways business school, generally can prepare you to do anything you want to do in the world. And I don't quite think that's true. I mean, if you
right.
want to go off and be, you know, an elementary school teacher, I'm just picking something, right?
Right.
That's probably not where you need to go next.
Right.
But there are myriad careers where a different path might make more sense.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And as you said, they really meant well. Like, these people really wanted to support me, but I think there was sort of a lack of reflection on their advice based on my personal interest.
Right. No, that's, you know, when we spoke a couple of weeks ago, I told you that I'm a firm believer that people need to know what they want to do with a degree before they go for the degree.
Mm-hmm.
Just, mm-hmm. At this point in time, just going for a graduate degree is way too expensive to just kind of say,
absolutely.
Any education is valuable, I'm going to go get more education. Yes, it's all valuable, but is it going to be the education that's going to give you the most value for your time and your money?
I think for some reason, law school and business school is just seen as a catch-all.
Yeah.
Nobody would ever do that for med school, for example.
No.
Right. People would not just say, well, you know, this will be great. I'll make a lot of money.
They did. When I was in high school and college, they did.
Mm-hmm.
It was like if you were scientifically oriented and, yes, you wanted to make money, then you went to med school. That's something that's changed in the last 30 years. I think probably because of the rise of high tech and managed care,
mm-hmm.
a combination. So I remember very clearly that was the case. You know, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, that the best and the brightest who were scientifically inclined mm-hmm. went to med school almost mm-hmm. mindlessly.
Right. Yeah. And I think at least at one point that was true for law school.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
Now in some ways it's true for business school.
What advice would you today give the Akiba Smith Francis of the early 2000s?
That's an interesting question. Let's see. You know, I think one is to just know that everything will be all right. You know, I think, when I was kind of in my early 20s, I thought every decision that I made was going to be monumentally important, sort of a life or death decision, which created so much stress and pressure versus kind of stepping back and thinking about the fact that, like, I'll be able to figure it out and I'll be all right. Some of that comes, of course, with time and experience,
yeah.
but I think that's something that I would tell my younger self. And also just to check in and remember what's important to me, you know, my values and what impact I want to have in the world and in life, because it's very easy to be seduced by what other people think is important,
yeah.
right,
mm-hmm.
or what
mm-hmm.
other people are doing, whether it's Harvard Business School or whether it's a particular career path. And not every school or every career is going to be a good fit for everyone, and so it's important to kind of have that foundation of knowledge of what it is that's important.
Right.
And the last thing that I would say is to just get clear as quickly as I can about my strengths and kind of focus on cultivating those things. I think the younger me was really focused on shoring up my weaknesses. And the amount of energy it takes to shore up your weaknesses to get them to a sort of a baseline level of competence, it's really all you need to spend versus really trying to focus on getting your weaknesses up to a point at which they're exceptional. And it's just not fun. Right? it's not fun. Like, I spent so much time. I am a words person. I'm an ideas person.
Right.
I can do financial analysis.
Yeah.
But I'm never going to be great at it.
Yeah.
Versus somebody else. Like, I can put my head down and grind through it.
Right.
Who wants to spend their life grinding through? I mean, I'm never going to be great at it. And so, I should have probably a little bit earlier in my career. Although, you figure these out when you figure these things out. But gotten clear about what my strengths are and really investing in those things to become exceptional in those areas.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. My younger son came to me when he was, he'd done a gap year, mm-hmm. two gap years actually, and then he was starting college. And as he was about to start, he calls me up one day, and he was positively not. He was trying to figure out what he should major in.
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying to decide between accounting, computer science, and I think math or engineering or something like that. And he hadn't yet started. And he's like, well, what should I major in? You know, I mean, I want to be able to support myself. I want to be able to support, he was 19 at the time. I want to be able to support a family. And,
right.
And I said, well, why don't you just try taking classes in these areas and see what you like?
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, what I like? I said, yeah. but what about, you know, the money? You know, I need to be able to, you know, he knew I wasn't going to support him forever. I need to be able to support myself. I want to be able to support a family. And I said, well, if you go into any of these three fields, you can make a good living. You might as well choose what you enjoy.
Yeah.
And he said, really? I said, yeah, look, if you were telling me you wanted, and I remember giving this example, speaking of the example you gave earlier a few minutes ago, I said, if you told me you wanted to go into early childhood education or be a preschool teacher, then you'd really be making a lifestyle choice with that professional decision. I said, but the three majors that you're considering, you can make tons of money with those fields, depending upon how you progress and all that and the specific choices you make beyond. But for you as a, you know, starting in college, I said, just figure out which one you like. And he thought about it and he followed my advice, but I was particularly pleased because a year later, a friend of his was doing the exact same thing. A friend was a year younger. And he said, Mom, I want you to know, I gave him your advice. I said, what was my advice? So he repeated back what I had told him, which is sheer gold for a parent of an adult child.
Yeah.
But the point is when you're making these career decisions, and this goes back to finding your strengths, he was definitely going towards his strengths. He's a numbers guy.
Mm-hmm.
When you're going towards, when you're making those decisions, and you are going in a direction where you're not going to be dealing with dramatic differences in income, then just go with what you enjoy. And if you are going to make a decision where you see it could dramatically affect income, you don't necessarily have to go for the highest paying. You may decide that what you enjoy is more important than the money, and that's a legitimate decision. You should just make that decision with your eyes open.
Absolutely. I mean, that's where I go back to that. You know, that comment I made about the advice I would give myself, which is just to really know what's important, because, you know, for some people, money is not really that important.
Right.
Right. And it may be the case that they really are passionate about making a difference in early childhood education where you're, you know, who knows, right? But you're probably not, I wouldn't go in expecting to get rich doing this.
Mm-hmm.
But if that is more important to you than the money that you'll make, as long as you can support yourself and live, that's a completely legitimate choice. And I think sometimes people assume that for everyone, money or status is going to be the driving, you know, factor in someone's decision around career. And, this is where I go back to just really knowing what's important to you and also knowing your strengths. mm-hmm. which I think people have a hard time articulating. I don't know if you find that, Linda, in the work that you do with admissions consulting, but I find that most people actually have a hard time articulating their values, what's important to them, and even what they're good at.
I think they have a lot of trouble articulating values and thinking independently about what's important to them. I think all too often they are responding to what's expected of them. I think it was in the conversation that we had a couple of weeks ago, I told you about a speech. I went to my nephew's graduation, and the president of USC happened to be retiring that year. And he gave a speech, this has already been several years, that really stuck with me. Because he told the graduates, he says, I really want you to think about three things. I want you to think about what you think about God, religion, not what people expect you to think, but what you think. I want you to think about what you think about money, not what people expect you to think, but what you think. Again, is it important to you, or are other things more important to you? And finally, I want you to think about family. Is it important to you, or is it less important to you? And not what people expect, but what you really, in your heart of heart, think and value. And I thought it was a tremendously profound message to those young adults leaving USC at the time. And I think it's a profound message for young adults in general, because they really have to figure out not just what's expected of them, but what really is important to them. And I think that's kind of what we're talking about here. Now, you mentioned strength as and values as being something that young adults or people considering a graduate degree and ultimately trying to figure out what they want to do professionally should consider. And we talked about the importance of finding work that you enjoy. So, to paraphrase Edison, it's all fun. And we've talked about a few things, but how does one choose the desired career direction? And I realize that's an enormous question. There are probably books about it, libraries about it. So yeah. Could you maybe break it down to the top three or X tips for finding meaningful, enjoyable work that one can call fun?
Sure. I think the first thing, particularly when you're starting your career, is to be open to as many opportunities as possible and sort of test and learn. Mm-hmm. So, the experience I was telling you about regarding admissions consulting, I didn't even know that was a job at the time.
Right.
I had been just helping people on the side, friends of friends who were applying to business school. And so there's no way in the world that I would have applied to a job or even tried to prepare myself for a job that I didn't know existed.
Right.
So really be open to as many opportunities as possible and test and learn like they do in tech. Many times people who are ambitious, younger professionals, stay in their head around analyzing what a particular job or experience will be like. And the truth is you kind of just have to do it to know what it will really be like and to know if you're good at it and you like it.
Right.
So I could look at films of the Tour de France and read cycling publications all day long. But the only way that I would be able to know if I wanted to be a cyclist is to get on a bike.
Right.
I think with really cerebral work, we think we can just do informationals and figure it out. And certainly there's a place for informationals, but I think there's a huge value in internships or volunteer opportunities or even kind of carving out, if you can, within your day job, opportunities to do some of the kinds of things that you think you might want to do, just to really try it on and see and be curious and be open.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I would say is making time for reflection. I think this is hugely important and something that I certainly don't do enough of today. In our busy lives, we rarely make time for reflection on what it is that we've learned, how it is we feel about our work, or even certain aspects of work. So we might think, I'm happy with my job or I'm not happy with my job, without breaking it down into its component parts. What is it I love about it? What is it? Do I like the people? What about the people? The environment? The task? Maybe I'm not crazy about the tasks I'm doing today as an analyst, but when I look forward and I see two levels up, what do I think about those opportunities?
Right.
Carving out very specifically regular time for reflection, I think, is critical.
Almost like personal reviews.
Yeah, and unless you make the time for it, it's probably not going to happen.
Right.
And those decision points will sneak up on you. And then the last thing that I would say is, I've found that people, I think most people do have a hard time articulating what their strengths are, other than really sort of general things like I'm good with numbers or I'm really good at finance or something, which is not granular enough to help you figure out what might be transferable to another position.
Okay.
So, for example, if you work in finance and you feel like I'm pretty good at finance, but you don't necessarily want to go do if you work at a financial services firm but don't want to transition over to, let's say, a corporate finance role within a corporation, it's like, what do I do with that? There are slivers of what it is that you're really good at within any given role that can help you start to think about what's transferable and then almost, more importantly, talk about what might be transferable as you're engaging with people who work in a very different field. So you have to be clear on it before you can paint a picture for others for how you might be able to contribute.
Mm-hmm. I think your point is very well taken, that people, maybe that was a difference in our perspectives, that while most people can say I'm good with numbers or I'm good with words or ideas, I'm an ideas person, they're not terribly granular about it. And self-reflection, therefore, is all the more important.
And I think also just engaging with other people, particularly when you're really new in your career, about what it is that they see in you in terms of your strengths.
Sorry, you cut out. Go ahead.
Okay. Also, what I've seen, and I know this is true for me, is that I might think, I'm okay at this, whatever this happens to be. Mm-hmm. And people who have more years of experience and have seen large numbers of people come through an organization might be able to calibrate and say, actually, what you think is average is really exceptional, and you need to know that.
Yeah.
And so part of it is going to be self-reflection, but part of it will also be touching base with people whose opinion you respect, who have the breadth of experience to be able to tell you where your spikes are that you might not be able to recognize.
That's a really good point. That's an excellent point. Okay, now, a lot of times, MBA applicants or young people in general are advised, follow your passion. What advice do you have if the marketplace doesn't value what you find meaningful? You love Chinese medieval philosophy, but there aren't too many jobs in that field. What would you then advise a young professional to do?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the first thing is to just recognize that that's the case, right? So I will never say, do what you love and the money will follow, because as you said, in the case of that, it probably won't.
Right. Right?
And so just recognizing that that's the case. If you want to be a police officer, you're probably not going to be a millionaire if you want to be a police officer, right?
Right.
And it's not to say that that's not a valid career choice. It's just you have to have your eyes open as you step into a decision and know what's important to you.
Right.
Once you recognize that, I think you got to ask yourself, how important is money for me? And that answer may change over time, I realize, right? Once you start to have children, et cetera, like that calculation might change. You might decide, money is not that important to you in your first 5 years out of college, and you really want to explore or you really want to work as an apprentice. 20 years down the road, that might change. But again, just getting really clear on how important money is for you in your life. If you decide that it is pretty important and you take a job that pays pretty well, I would say try to find a way to carve out a space for you to do the work that you're really passionate about, to kind of fill your soul.
Mm-hmm.
Because work really shouldn't be everything.
Right.
It's important to be really deliberate about making space to do the things that you're passionate about, that really feed you and keep you motivated and will allow you to feel happy and then in turn more productive at work, quite frankly. I don't think there's a one size fits all answer, but it's just getting really clear on what priorities you're going to make and whether you can do this Chinese medieval philosophy stuff full time and still be happy.
Or maybe do it part time and still be happy, and maybe do something with China trade in the interim, or you know, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, there are tons of ways to figure out how you can incorporate your interests into either your professional life or just your personal life.
Right. I sometimes talk to 20-somethings who I think have been on this treadmill all their lives. You got to go to a certain preschool, to go to a private elementary middle school, to get into an elite high school, to get accepted to an Ivy League college, to get a job at Goldman or McKinsey.
Right.
It's a, what I call the treadmill. There's nothing wrong with going to great schools or at any point in one's life. And there's a lot to be said for working at fantastic companies like McKinsey or Goldman Sachs. But this to-do list or treadmill approach to life doesn't leave one a lot of room to reflect, which is what you were just talking about. It doesn't leave one with room to find purpose or meaning or passion or any of that stuff. It's just kind of you keep on going. How does one get off the treadmill? How does a young adult explore effectively when, you know, they're just trying to fill their resume with extracurriculars so that they can get into the next school?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you asked this question. I'm certainly familiar with the treadmill myself, having gone to, you know, competitive schools since, I would say, middle school through, you know, graduate school.
And they do give a fantastic education. You know, I know we've discussed this. I said, I'm a graduate admissions consultant. It's not like I'm opposed to education, for heaven's sake.
Right. Yeah, no, I think the key is stepping back and checking in with yourself, because I think what makes it a treadmill is the fact that it's often pursued mindlessly, right? I mean, if you really consciously, with your eyes wide open, say, because I really want to do this, I'm going to pursue this degree or this school or this career or this position even, then that's fine, right? If it ends up looking like what somebody else might consider a treadmill, but you do it very consciously, then that's great. I think the trouble comes in when people just see their classmates or other people doing it and will say, yeah, I guess I need to do that too. And then they wake up, you know, 27 or 30 or what, you know, 32 or even, I mean, I've even seen people in their kind of 40s say like, how did I get here?
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
It's sort of like they've been asleep at their life.
Yeah.
And so checking in and stepping back is key. One thing that I see a lot is people going into highly compensated positions, professional services firms, right after school because they're like, oh, I got a lot of loans, I need to pay this back.
Right.
Which, again, is fine. You need to decide what's important to you, and you're the only one that's going to be left with these loans, so you do what you got to do. However, if that is your primary goal there, again, do it really consciously and shovel money into your, you know, your school loans.
Mm-hmm.
Don't waste it, because what you don't want to have happen, which I see a lot, is at the end of 2 years or 3 years, you know, people are living in $3,000 a month apartments and still haven't paid down their loans.
Right.
And then they feel trapped, which is how the treadmill continues.
Right. And then they start their own families and they put their kids on it.
Right. And the other thing is to make a really conscious effort at building a pathway off of that treadmill. Mm-hmm. And so what I mean is cultivating a network in the space that you want to be in after a few years, right? Making sure that you're employable. And so what that means is, do you have the knowledge base and do you have the expertise in terms of skills to be able to get a job in that field? I see it a lot, and I remember hearing, I think it was the founder of Bridgeband, which is a nonprofit consulting firm, say that he often saw people coming out of finance, like, you know, 10, 12 years in finance, wanting to work in nonprofit because they kind of made their money and say, well, great, I can now run a nonprofit. And it's like, no, you can't. I mean, you have to really work to establish your bona fides in that new field.
Right.
And so being really conscious about that along the way, because it takes time. It takes time to cultivate a network.
Right.
It takes time to understand who the players are. They need to have known you to go out on the limb and give you an opportunity. And that's tough to do when you're trying to live life and perform well in the job and the career that you have currently.
Right, right. And, of course, that's one of the reasons that people frequently do go, especially to business school.
I mean, mm-hmm.
I always say I think it's a tremendously expensive way to get a network, but I look at a network as something that's a clear benefit of a business school, but I don't think it should be the driver for going in a particular direction.
I totally agree.
Yeah, yeah. And this actually, your comments just were anticipating my next question, which is, what is the role of networking in determining career direction? I mean, obviously, if you have a particular network, it tends to influence you to go in a particular direction.
Mm-hmm,
you
mm-hmm.
need usually a network to go in a direction once you determine the direction you want to go in. So there's a little bit of a symbiotic relationship, perhaps?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually have a lot of thoughts on this.
Go ahead.
So, in no particular order, one is I think exactly for the reason that you mentioned, it's important to have a diverse network in terms of people with different life experiences, professional and educational backgrounds, so that you're not stuck in sort of a silo in which everybody you know does exactly what you do and knows all the same people, because you won't really grow from that. So it's important to really invest in and cultivate relationships with people who don't do or look like anything like you look like. I mean, not in a craven way, but, you know, just be open to forming connections with people who aren't also in, you know, the same club that you're in, for example, at business school. I think that's a really obvious thing to do, that you'll want to form connections with people who have similar professional interests. But, you know, who knows, if 5 years or 10 years down the road you want to take a really different tack to your career, you might need to reach out to people who are doing something wildly different. And it's sort of tough to go back to people years down the road when you haven't maintained that relationship and ask them for help, right?
Right.
The other thing is to work at maintaining those relationships, which, again, is really tough because we're all so busy. But making time to connect with people and reconnect with people, I think, is critical. And making sure that you reciprocate and help other people.
Yeah.
What's that phrase? You got to be a friend before you can make a friend, or you need a friend?
Yeah. Well, I always go back to the Brownie Scout motto, make new friends but keep the old. One is silver, the other is gold.
Yeah. And I think sometimes people think about networking in terms of what other people can do for them.
Right.
But you also need to, you know, be known as somebody who others want to call for advice or help, and be known as a helpful person as opposed to being thought of as the person who just calls them when they need help.
Right. I was very impressed. I was on Georgetown's MBA site at one point, and they defined networking as a giving process.
And,
you know, the ability to give to others, to contribute to others.
That's great, which I think is very true
and not usually how it's
reframing. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's sort of thought of as like, what can you do for me?
Right.
And then the other thing that I would say is to not be afraid to connect with people who are more senior than you are, because I think some of the stuff that we talked about earlier, they can give you a different perspective because they have the long view.
Mm-hmm.
And often I think what people will do is look for a mentor, official or unofficial. And while I think that's helpful, using that language almost makes it less of an authentic relationship, right? And connect with the people that you just happen to connect with and contribute to them. You can add value even if you're, you know, 20 years younger. You can add value in that relationship, and it needs to be a symbiotic relationship that people want to engage in.
Right.
And so I would say that networking doesn't just mean your peers, but cultivate relationships, true relationships with people of all ages. And I think quality is probably more important than quantity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I recently interviewed Ben Fall, who's a recent HBS grad, and he has on his LinkedIn profile, and I'm paraphrasing it, but it's something along the lines of, I'm open to all relationships, but if they're just going to be transactional, sorry, life's too short. Something along the lines. I don't have it, you know, I don't have it memorized, but it was something like that. You know, he did not want just it relationships, that's for sure.
Yeah, now, that's great.
Yeah, it really stuck with me. Now, you are currently working in leadership development, and one of the things I noticed specifically with recent GMEC data is that it's not the spreadsheet skills that are most valued by employers, and it's not the technical skills that are most valued by alumni. It's usually the leadership and the soft skills that people acquire specifically in business school. And, of course, business schools now do have, probably as a result of recruiter feedback, tremendous leadership development programs that they really highlight and tout. If applicants are to go, and I think obviously many of them are correctly looking at what they want to do professionally and which are the schools that have the best placement in those fields, and I think that's very appropriate. But given the increasing importance and value of these leadership development programs, how does an applicant assess them?
Assess a business school in relation to it?
How does like they all have leadership development programs. So at this point, and you're looking, let's say somebody's accepted at two programs and they're satisfied that both programs are going to support their goals. And they realize that leadership development is a key differentiator among potential recruits in the job market or leadership skills. So the leadership development program should be something that they look at. How does an applicant assess a leadership development program?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say one of the things to look at is exactly what the program looks like in terms of how you'll be learning. So adults typically learn by doing as opposed to reading theory, right? So my guess is that some of these will be, you know, sort of traditional lecture-based classes, and others will involve exercises or team projects or opportunities to do, let's say, some pro bono work in the community with organizations in the area that the school is located. And so just take a look at what those leadership opportunities look like. And I would err on the side of active learning, experiential learning, particularly with regard to leadership. And then I would speak to second-year students or recent alums about their experience and specifically ask them about it, ask them what they learned, ask them if they're using what they've learned in their jobs, if they're, you know, if they're recent graduates, because I think much of the kind of the detail and the sort of meat of what goes on is going to have to be teased out through conversation, versus just looking at a description on email
or a website.
Yeah, sorry, because I meant a website. Yeah. Absolutely.
Right, because it does seem like the differentiators in terms of hiring are no longer necessarily the. I mean, it's assumed that MBAs have spreadsheet, decision tree, accounting, finance skills. But what's going to distinguish them actually are the soft skills.
Yeah, which are actually the harder ones.
Right. Yeah.
How to manage people, how to influence people, how to bring stakeholders together, how to handle conflict. Actually incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
And I remember hearing that when we had our lead class. First semester, first year at HBS, you know, a lot of the speakers that came in would say, this is the stuff that is incredibly difficult, and this is what you really need to be focused on. And, you know, I think a lot of folks didn't really hear it, and they were worried about, you know, Finance One or something. Not to say that isn't important, but I think you don't really realize it until you get out there, you get back into the work world and realize that the soft skills, so to speak, are really what will enable you to succeed or not.
Right. Do you have any final words of advice or suggestions for young people trying to determine a career path and choose a direction in life?
Yeah, I would reiterate a couple things, which is make time for reflection.
Yeah.
Understand what is really important to you and what your strengths are, and you may need to engage with somebody else to illuminate that. You know, I'd also say that it's a marathon and not a sprint, and it's mm-hmm. not going to be linear. I mean, the one thing I would say is it's not going to be a straight line, and so just to be okay with that, right?
Right. I actually think that one of the biggest changes probably in the last 30, 50 years is that people can almost assume they're going to change professions and
mm-hmm.
jobs
mm-hmm.
in their career. So your advice, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, so I hope you're going to finish what you were saying, is even more relevant about it not being a sprint. It's a marathon, and it's something that you're going to be doing really for your entire professional life.
And so that's why some of these kind of meta skills are so important, right?
Mm-hmm.
Figuring out what you're good at in a detailed enough way so that when you do transition, you can speak to it in a way that somebody who works outside of your first career, for example,
mm-hmm.
you really understand and appreciate, right, that idea of having a really diverse network, because you might not know where you're going, you know, 5 or 10 years from now, but you can almost bet it's not going to be where you started out. And
right.
so having that diverse network of people who can kind of shape your thoughts about what's possible
mm-hmm.
and also help you gain entree into this new career are really important. And then just having that foundation, right, of what is it that's really important to me and making time to figure that out. And the other thing I would say is, you know, consider investing in a coach. So I think, you know, people are going to be coming to Accepted to specifically get coaching and guidance around the process of getting into business school.
Right.
And it may be the case that as you get more senior in your career, you are going to need somebody who's sort of objective with regard to you. People certainly talk to friends or family, classmates, et cetera, people within their company to figure out where to go next. But those people often have a real vested interest or opinion about where you should go. And
right.
so that's where I think the value of a coach can come in, because they don't have a, you know, they shouldn't anyway, have an opinion about what your career should look like. And so that may be something to consider a little bit farther down the road. But I think that's something that people should kind of keep in the back of their mind. You don't have to do it by yourself. You don't have to figure this out by yourself.
Right. That's great advice. Akiva, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I've really enjoyed chatting with you again. And I'm glad that this time Admission Straight Talk listeners are also going to benefit from your insight and perspective on the whole choosing a career challenge. Where can listeners learn more about your work?
A couple places. They could contact me on LinkedIn.
Okay.
Guessing I'm the only Akiva Smith Francis out there.
Right. And we'll include a link.
Okay, great. And then the other thing I would say is I've been working on a blog for a while called steppingoffthepath.com.
Okay.
And so they can see the stories of both my story, changing careers, as well as other people's stories who kind of left their initial career to do something wildly different and all the sort of messiness involved in that process.
Okay. We'll include links in the show notes to both those sites at info.exhibit.com/65. And we're a listener, you can learn more in greater depth about Akiva's work and her story. Listener, thank you too for joining Akiva and me for our 65th episode. If you find the show worthwhile, please share the good word by leaving a review on iTunes. Your doing so will help us spread the word about Admission Straight Talk, because iTunes will rank Admission Straight Talk more prominently if it has more reviews, especially if it has 5-star feedback. So if you think we deserve the 5 stars, please let iTunes know. There is a link in the show notes to our iTunes page where you can leave a review. Again, the show notes are at info.exhibit.com/65.
And if you have a question for me, please ask it at info.exhibit.com/65 or by sending an email to questions@accepted.com. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.